Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European macro research at Natixis. And with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Yeah, welcome also from my side. So today we are very happy to have with us Professor Ludger Wössmann, one of the most eminent researchers in education economics worldwide, I'd say. And we'd like to discuss about the role of education in economic growth. That's something that's really important for Europe, as some countries are in a dire need to boost their growth potential. So welcome to the podcast, Ludger.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Ludger is professor of economics at the University of Munich and is also head of research center on the economics of education located at the IFO Institute in Munich, Germany. So in a long list of publications, Ludger Wössmann has asked and answered fundamental questions about the relationship between education on the one hand and economic well-being on the other hand. So there are important questions such as, how are education and economic growth linked? How does education affect individuals' welfare? What are the determinants of student performance in schools? The relationship between resources, teachers, and school performance? And what are the polit-economic factors behind education policy? So it's really an impressive amount of work, and we're eager to hear about his insights. So let's start with something quite fundamental. So, Ludger, you've written a seminal paper about the relationship between cognitive skills and economic growth. And there seems to be a strong relationship in the data pointing towards both the relevance of a minimum skill set for economic growth on the one hand, and on the other hand, the importance of skill complementarity for economic growth. So what have we learned from this line of research?
Well, I guess the key idea for all this and why education may be relevant for growth in the first place is that we can interpret or understand education as an investment in human capital. So just like we invest in factories and firms and so on, human beings can also decide to invest in their own capacity and their own capital. And that's what we like to call human capital, or, as I'm going to argue in a minute, maybe even better, knowledge capital. And so the more education you accumulate, the more productive you become, and therefore the more you can produce. At the macro level, this aggregates, but even more importantly, maybe, is the fact that the education of the population is really a key driver of the R&D sector, and therefore of technological change, and that's really driving the long-run growth rates of economies. So now if we want to look at that empirically to see like how relevant this really is, research used to be, first of all, look at years of schooling, like the average years of schooling in the adult population as a measure of education. And results were somewhat mixed. I think in a basic framework, actually with a simple model that just has years of schooling and the initial level of the GDP per capita of a country, the long-run growth rate across countries, you can maybe account for a quarter of the difference across countries with such a model. But I think a key problem with this setup and where we try to enrich the debate was that we know that the quality of what's going on in schools can be very different in different countries. And basically, in such a simple model, you just assume that a year of schooling in one country gives you the same productive capital as in any other country. And to rather try to get a measure of the quality of this as well, we suggested we might just use basic student achievement tests as a measure of what students have actually learned in schools, and so of the skills that the population has accumulated. So think of things like the PISA test, that's an internationally comparable test in math and science and reading. And then we just took lots of like PISA predecessor tests and used that to measure the average achievement of the population in math and science. And if you use this as a measure of what you may actually call the knowledge capital of a nation, because it's really what the people know, then such a simple model can literally account for more than three quarters of the differences in the long-run growth rates across countries, when you really think about like 40, 50 years. I mean, if you think about the really big picture that we as economists may want to try to understand, say people in East Asia today are roughly 9 times as prosperous as their grandparents, so as 2 generations ago, whereas in Latin America, that's only 2.5 times. And so these are huge differences in the extent to which some regions of the world have become very prosperous and others haven't. And that's pretty much a surprise. And these long-run growth rates, you cannot account for with standard observables that you generally use. And if you just add this one measure of what the people have learned, you literally can fully account for this East Asian growth miracle and also for the slow growth puzzle in Latin America.
So what are the relevant skills that come out of these regressions?
So, I mean, just empirically, the strongest predictors is math skills and similarly science skills. But to be honest, I wouldn't push this too far because, for example, math skills across countries are super closely correlated with reading skills. So if you do a horse race and run them against each other, math skills will come through. But maybe that's because it's easier to measure math across countries rather than reading across countries. And so I literally wouldn't push this too far. But the point is that these are very basic skills. So it's not higher level math or anything. It's really the basic skills that you need to understand the world, to understand everything else. And with these kind of really basic skills, you can pretty much account for big chunks of the growth differences across the world.
I guess reading skills are less internationally comparable depending on the alphabet you carry. That could be, you know, comparatively easy or, say, in Chinese or Mandarin, more demanding.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, so these psychometricians who try to measure these things, they like kind of debate about this, to what extent that's possible. Many argue that it's possible. And if you basically look at the results and the fact that results are quite similar across the different subjects, it probably means that you can measure these basic skills. And most of all, what it means, like the fact that these are so predictive of countries' long-run growth, really tells you that there's something about it that's really measured there that's very relevant.
So you found, and I found it very convincing, without being an expert here, that a big part of the difference in terms of growth performance between countries can be attributed to skill set. Then the obvious question is, how can you ensure that your educational system, your school systems is such that you have as much human and knowledge capital as possible? What constitutes a good school system? What should be done from a policy point of view to ensure that indeed you have the best school system you can have afford?
Yeah, surprisingly, actually, this is what it's probably not about. And it's really not so much about how much you spend on schools or the class size. So most people care a lot about class sizes, parents and teachers and so on. Interestingly, there's a huge literature on this. And I mean, nearly all the studies find zero effects. It's really like as long as you're not in a system where you've got 80 kids in a classroom, but rather somewhere between whatever, 20 and 30, it makes hardly any difference for what students actually learn. And that also means that if you look across countries, it's just there's no correlation among rich countries between class size and student learning or expenditure per student in terms of euros per kid you put into the education system and outcomes. So what this really tells us, it's what's rather more important is how efficiently the resources that you have are used. And that's, of course, a bit harder policy questions of what to do. One line of research that looks into this suggests that the institutions or the institutional structures of school systems are really important here. And examples for that would be things like accountability or autonomy or a private competition. So let's think about accountability. So some school systems have some sort of standardized testing or some student achievement test, either at the end, so exit exams that are comparable across schools or in between. And what we generally see is that students perform much better in countries that have these systems than they don't have. Or there's research looking at reforms when these are introduced, student achievement becomes better. So it's really about having a clear goal and defining the outcome that you want to have a focus on outcome, not just on inputs. And then also at some stage measuring it and basically probably mostly indirectly holding people accountable for what the outcomes are. So it means that if you don't have comparable testing, then schools or teachers can do whatever they want and no one will ever realize whether they actually literally like improving the knowledge and skills of the students or if they don't. Whereas if you have these achievement tests that are comparable, then you cannot do that, and that probably holds them accountable. And then once you have that, there seems to be some indication, particularly once the system is running at a reasonably decent level, that giving schools more autonomy, so like giving schools freedom to decide on which teachers to hire or like on how to spend the money and so on, seems to be also something that has a pretty strong impact on student achievement positively, but really only in the combination with accountability. So if you give schools autonomy, but no one asks what they're using that for, that can literally backfire. So there's some evidence that it can have even negative effects. Whereas once you have, say, standardized exit exams, then like students do best if schools have autonomy. So the best is a combination of like setting the goal and also like testing in the end whether you've achieved the goal, but then letting schools find the best way to get there. And another part of this school autonomy, in a sense, like an but actually beyond that, is there is some indication that countries that have more schools that have private operation. So, and it's important here to differentiate between private operation and private funding. So private funding, of course, at least if you would like have more private funding for schools, you would increase inequality big time. And there's no indication that that would actually improve outcomes. But private operation, private management is something that gives parents more choice across different schools. And apparently that also works in the school system, where once there's more choice, it seems like overall the boat rises for everybody, the tide rises and achievement becomes better.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So now let's look a little bit at the situation where we stand, say in Europe, in terms of student achievement. You have mentioned the internationally comparison tests in the PISA study. So where does Europe stand in the student achievement, in particular in comparison to Asia or say other world regions?
I mean, it's a very general statement. I mean, we are somewhere in the middle. it's actually kind of, I mean, the latest evidence that we have really in this sense isn't that up to date. It's actually the PISA study from 2018, and usually it's every 3 years, but this has been postponed due to COVID, and so we will not learn until the end of this year what the latest update is. And it's actually, we see from many studies that COVID had really profound effects, meaning that like with schools closed and with social distancing rules and so on, many kids hardly learned anything. And it's also very interesting to see that apparently results differ a lot across countries how COVID affected outcomes. So countries like Germany, but also some other countries, show huge learning losses, whereas actually some countries that were much faster in instituting online education and making sure that learning goes on, like Sweden or Denmark, you see hardly any losses. So that will be interesting to see. But still, the big picture, actually, of course, like which countries do very good and not so good, is pretty persistent over time. And it tells us that actually Europe has very different performers. So Estonia is literally the top performer among the OECD countries, at least in reading. And Finland is also a country that's close by, not so much in math, but actually in reading as well. And at the other end, countries like Greece or the Slovak Republic are really at the bottom, followed only by countries like Chile, Mexico, or Colombia. And if we just look at the large economies in Europe, Germany, the UK, France are really countries that are quite middling, really pretty much average. Whereas countries like Italy and Spain are literally much below OECD average. And then if you compare that internationally, interestingly, the US is also very middling. Then Canada is a country that's actually very close to the top, like Estonia. And also countries like Japan and Korea. So these Asian countries are, particularly in math, are really top. But all these OECD countries are far outperformed by countries like Singapore, but also Hong Kong or Taiwan. So these countries really somehow make sure that the kids there learn a lot of these basic skills, and all the kids are learning it. Also, like, there's actually from in China, only a few, like four big coastal provinces are participating. These are the rich provinces. And these literally outperformed everybody, every other country when they participated. So there's a huge human capital component to what's going on in China. But it's also like, this is really not the whole picture, because, I mean, they only send their best performing regions to participate, which no other country was allowed to do. And we know from a few internal studies that actually there are other regions, like the more inland regions in China, that like performing much worse and are among like the least performing countries in the world, which probably means that this regional inequality is also within China a human capital story. And then we can contrast all of this, like just to finish up the big picture, with countries in the very poor world regions, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And we recently did a study that tried to get an impression of that. And this is, they are really doing dismally. Like basically, if you even like 90% of children in these regions literally are below a super basic skill level, so with hardly any learning.
Why, just to follow up on this quickly, why do you think that so many countries in Europe are happy with being in this middling average position? I mean, if the aspiration is in engaging into systems competition, et cetera, grading dynamic environments and so on, how come they settle with this mediocre average position?
I don't think they're happy with it, but you're right. I think they don't care enough. And it's a big question why that is. I mean, I think part of it is that it doesn't seem to be obvious to everybody how important this is. And this seems to be really different in Asian countries, where they just realize that education is like the thing that makes sure that you can like have success in life later on. Of course, all of this isn't easy, and you really have to do something for it. It's like a lot of effort. It's effort by parents, it's effort by children. Then you've got to get the best teachers into schools, and all of that is something where apparently, like societies, but particularly also politicians, shy away. I mean, if I look at the German experience during the COVID period, it's kind of like the school education was the first thing to be given away, and no one like really care too much about it, and at least care about that students actually learn something during the time. That's pretty frightening, actually.
Let's assume a government that is not happy with the results of its educational tests would approach you and say, okay, I want to reform my school system. What would you recommend? What works? And is there any country, big country in Europe, where you think that should really tackle its educational problems in order to get ahead?
Well, I guess it's particularly like the lowest achieving countries. So like among the bigger countries, Italy, Spain really have to get their act together there, but also Germany and other countries. And in the end, many of these policy issues will be quite country specific. I mean, education systems are really differ a lot, have long traditions, which doesn't make general statements very easy. But overall, it seems particularly for countries like also like Spain and so on, that this real lack of accountability or lack of knowledge of transparency of where we actually stand, of like a standardized measure that gives us comparable information on how students are performing, is kind of the most important basis for any policy action. Actually, if you don't know where different schools are standing, how should you act on that? And therefore, this overall accountability, centralized student testing is probably the most important reform for many systems. And then combine it with school autonomy. In many countries, we have like really school system is the final part of a like centrally planned economy, where in Germany, most schools cannot even choose the personnel that they want to do it. There's like a central agency that in any centrally planned economy, assigns teachers to schools. On top of these general institutional reforms, I guess, I mean, one important step to really improve is to have particular focus and particular support for the most disadvantaged students, because we've talked a lot about schools now, but it's also like a strong determinant of student achievement is actually the family background, like just like the education background of the parents, the socioeconomic background of the parents. That's, of course, pretty hard for policymakers to address directly. And it's going to have very, like, many determinants, including just how much you value an important, a decent education for the children. But that means, I guess, that as societies in terms of policymaking, we should particularly focus efforts on those children that don't get the support automatically from their families. And then, like, having particular support programs, just like tutoring or mentoring or anything that helps kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, will probably have the biggest achievement gains to be gained.
Right. So you also looked at individual performance. In particular, you showed that character traits, besides just knowledge that we have emphasized so far, seem to be an important determinant of human capital formation. And these are things we as parents try to teach our children, usually, such as patience, certain attitudes to risk, like avoiding excessive risk-taking behavior and so on. So how important are these character traits now for long-run success of individuals?
Yeah, we actually, like, this is one of the most recent like projects we did, and we were really surprised how important these are. I mean, I always thought, like, I mean, if you think about education as investment, then it's kind of obvious that patience, like whether you've got a long-term orientation, could have an impact here, and that's why we looked at it. But literally just these two general traits, where like recently some research groups have come up with a way of measuring patience and risk-taking activities across countries. Just these two traits literally can account for 2/3 of the cross-country variation in student achievement. That doesn't mean that you cannot do anything about it. I mean, first of all, I mean, the one interesting thing is that these effects are quite orthogonal, so unrelated to the institutional effects we talked about. So you can always improve by changing your education system. The other thing is actually that, yeah, these character traits, as you may want to put them, are probably pretty deep cultural traits, but on the other hand, they are also malleable. And there's actually a lot of research recently showing, like, first of all, you can, like, what you do in schools affects that. Or, like, we recently did a major study of a mentoring program where it's, like, just particularly for very disadvantaged children, if you get a mentor, like a university student, they do it voluntarily and just start to, like, get into a real relationship with these youth. And this is actually at an older age, like for 14, 15-year-olds before they leave school. And support them, start to think about them together with them, what their future, what they could be doing. We saw pretty big effects on these adolescents' patients. And so that's probably also something we could try to think on how to address best in our societies.
So one other important aspect, certainly in Europe, given the aging of the societies and the European societies, that we have to increasingly rely on immigration. Just to ensure that there's enough labor around. And immigrants come, of course, with rather different backgrounds and different skill sets. What could we do in Europe better to integrate these people into our economies? And what are the challenges here for the educational system? And how does it work if people come to Europe, if they're young and then come into the school system? Does that work, or is there a lot of failure?
I guess main difference we have to have in here is the difference between like refugee migration and migration that is really like organized migration in order to help labor and skills shortages. I think in the second part, probably as European societies, we should start to think about how to attract people with the right skills to begin with. For refugees, of course, these people just come to our countries to find shelter, and so we have to make sure to, like, whatever their background is, to integrate them as well as possible. But there, really, research shows it's, again, education that is key. It's like two parts. So the one thing is the proficiency of the national language, because otherwise it's really hard to integrate, both for children and for adults. And then the professional qualifications you need to be successful on the labor market. So for children, I guess, particularly for young children, like, a key insight is that it's really important to integrate them into normal schools and classrooms and not to segregate them from the native population. Because if you do that as fast as possible, like particularly young children just soak up the national languages. And it's really about this daily interaction with native speakers that helps them get into the country. And then they can certainly help our skill shortage problems rather than hinder it. And it's probably even important to think about it even earlier on, as early as possible, even before school time in daycare centers, integrate them, give them a little bit of language support. But mostly these young children soak up languages, and then it's really about giving them the skills to succeed in our modern labor markets.
What does the empiric say so far? How does that work in the past? Did the integration of, say, the 2015 immigration wave, refugee wave, do we have data on that? How well did that work out?
It differs across countries, I guess, and I don't think we have a very good overview of how that worked. And it's question is like, what's your aspiration in here? It's just a very long process, and like for Germany, we can say it just takes very long. And if we would have invested much more early on in language skills and in professional skills, and we probably could stand much better. But because in the end, refugee integration for refugees with relatively low skilled backgrounds is very, very slow.
Okay, I'll try a quick summary. Or Klaus, do you have a final question before I try that? Cognitive skills and economic growth, they matter quite a lot. If you think about those cognitive skills as knowledge capital, so it increases your capital stock, and of course that's what matters. In fact, you said 3/4 of growth differences can be attributed by these differences in the quality of education between countries. There's some measurement problems, so not just counting the number of school years is enough, but rather you need to refer to tests and all that. But if you do that, you find it really matters. The school system, it's not about how much you spend on it necessarily, size, class size, and all that doesn't matter that much. It's more the structure of the school system. In particular, accountability and testing is what you stressed as very important here. The European situation, well, we're somewhere in the middle looking at the different industrialized countries. And within Europe, we have a wide variety in terms of performance. Some countries do very well, others not so much. How to reform, if that's needed. Again, you stressed accountability and transparency. There is not an easy answer, not least because there are big cultural differences and historical differences in terms of the school system in each country, but again, accountability should help quite a bit. Character traits matter a lot. I guess all the parents would subscribe to that. Patience and all that can explain also a lot in terms of school achievement. And finally, immigration. Of course, skill-based immigration, what many countries start doing and will do, that's the easy part, if you will, how to deal with refugees. How to integrate them is more difficult, but when the earlier one starts, the earlier one ensures that the language barrier is not a barrier anymore, the better. In terms of how have we succeeded, going back to the 2015 crisis, you said that's not so straightforward, and it will take in any case some time to assess that. Was that a fair summary of what you said?
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you for that. And I guess we now all have to go back to our desk and improve our cognitive skills. Anyway, thanks a lot for your time today. I learned a lot. So my skill set somewhat at the margin has improved. I hope our listeners too. Speak to you soon. Bye.